You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
What is your need for affiliation? Because if it's too high, you're going to need to be liked, and you're going to be unwilling to engage in conflict. You're not going to be an effective leader, or you're going to be less effective than you might be. What's your need for achievement? Because if you got to do it your way, if you got to demonstrate how personally capable you are, you're going to have less of, it's going to be harder for you to operate at scale through other people. And what's your degree of impulse control? That can't translate into self-aggrandizing displays. Otherwise, it's going to turn people off. So all of those are avenues for me to work with a client on what is getting in their way, what is preventing them from being more influential and powerful.
Why did I become an executive coach? I saw lots of great people fail to get ahead at work, while their much less talented peers blew right past them. That made me furious, but also curious. What were great people getting wrong? It came down to helping them re-examine what drove success and then helping them make critical shifts, one hard truth at a time.
Feel like you're doing everything you were told, but you're not moving ahead at work nor having the impact you seek? Then welcome to 97% Effective with Michael Winderoth, where we skip feel-good, happy talk and engage experts in pointed conversations about what it really takes to move the needle at work and your career. So if you feel stalled or frustrated or seek that extra edge as you move to the next level, then look no further. This is the Hard Truths Playbook you never got.
Hi, I'm Michael Winderoth, and you're listening to 97% Effective. This episode is dedicated to power struggles among nice people. An intriguing article written by today's guest and our topic today, power. In the view of my guest and myself, power is critical to effective leadership and getting things done, but is a word, a concept that makes nice people absolutely cringe. So be ready. You might cringe, but you will learn as I discuss nice people and power with the one and only Ed Batista. Ed is a titan, a longtime executive coach to CEOs and senior leaders. He spent 15 years as lecturer at Stanford Business School, where he earned his MBA and where I first met him as we were classmates. And prior to coaching and his work at Stanford, Ed spent more than a decade in management roles, launching three organizations. But most of all, and what I appreciate most about Ed, is that he is a prolific and deep thinker and writer, a very rare combination these days, both in Harvard Business Review and on his website where he keeps a running blog, edbatista.com. He does a fantastic job breaking down research and sharing insights from his practice on the science and art of coaching. If you feel like there's a stark and nasty choice when it comes to power. Be an arrogant narcissist and win, or a nice guy and lose, this episode is for you. Ed and I are here to discuss why it doesn't have to be that way and how coaching can help you through these seeming dilemmas. Ed, I know for a long time you did not speak publicly or do media appearances, but I sense that is either changing or you decided that my show or my pilgrimage to Petaluma, as I call it, was worth it. Honored, super honored to have you on. Welcome to 97% Effective.
Oh, Michael, it's a pleasure to be here. And you're right. Yes, the opportunity to speak with you is very meaningful to me. And I began doing more media appearances in response to another, you know, a good friend of ours, Agnès Ley, and another classmate, Celine Teo, invited me to be on their podcast, a year or two ago. And I thought, well, that sounds like a lot of fun. So I did it, and I did have a lot of fun. And so I'm here and delighted to be here.
Well, let's have some fun today with this discussion. And I was reflecting on this as I had forgotten that I know we share a lot in common, but then I was looking like two history majors from liberal arts schools, then went into corporate careers. They were kind of non-traditional. We called them poets back then, who went and did their MBAs at Stanford. So I just thought that was interesting. And now we are both executive coaches.
I think that's very striking, especially when you think about the fact that that T group that you and I were in, that very first T group, four of us became executive coaches. So yeah, something was in the water.
Yeah, something was definitely in the water. And we are going to circle back to T groups, touchy-feely interpersonal dynamics. I wanted to start, Ed, because, you know, in my introduction here, you could go in lots of directions. Professor, writer, motivational speaker. So I wanted to start with asking you, you know, you've really settled in, you know, for the past 20 years in your practice into one-on-one coaching, and you've really, you know, been with it. You have a stable base of clients, are very much sought after, and particularly with tech CEOs. So that one-on-one coaching is your wheelhouse. So I wanted to ask just what drew you there and keeps you there, you know, what makes that kind of the high impact area that you like working in?
Well, my first exposure to coaching was as a client. You know, I wound up at a business school at Stanford because I wanted to help NGOs and nonprofits use technology more effectively. And the GSB was a great place to pursue that mission. And it was a dot-com era. You and I both looked at a bunch of different things. But I wound up coming back to the exact role that I'd written about in my application essay, helping NGOs use technology. And I wound up with that role. And I had a mentor on my board of directors who took me aside and said, "You're a talented guy, but you have some rough edges." You know, I was getting into a bunch of clashes with the members of my board. And he said, I want you to invest in yourself and go get an executive coach. I'd never heard of that before. My dad was a psychotherapist, though. And I thought, oh, okay, I understand what this is about. And I actually went back to Marianne Huckabee, the woman that we took interpersonal dynamics from, aka touchy feeling, and asked her if she'd be my coach. And she said, yes. So she had this profound impact on my understanding of leadership and allowed me to succeed in that role. A few years later, after I'd launched my own coaching practice, I went back to her and asked her if she'd be my coach again. And she and I have worked continuously for the last 16 years or so. So it was my experience of being coached that got me interested in coaching for the very first time. And then as my career developed, I just found that, well, I enjoyed one-on-one coaching the most. It felt like the area in which I could have the greatest impact. I did a lot of work with groups through my association with Stanford, teaching and facilitating. And that was a really, really rewarding combination. But over the years, my practice just wound up becoming increasingly focused on one-on-one work. And that's still the case today.
Ed, when you say rough edges, I just don't see that. I've seen you over the years, but of course, I haven't been there at work with you. And, you know, not to go in depth, and I know you continue to, you know, work with Marianne as your coach on a less frequent basis all these years. Just curious, was there one thing that she helped you most with that got you to work and address those rough edges?
Yeah, well, a specific challenge that I faced was in when I was doing that work in the nonprofit technology world is that I'd been so passionate about that for so long. And I thought that, oh, you know, in my capacity as leader of this organization seeking to promote these ideas and drive technology adoption in NGOs, you know, it's my job to come up with the best ideas and champion them, you know, really assertively. And I really thought that, you know, that was the leader's job to essentially kind of, you know, have the best ideas and ensure that they won. And what I wound up doing, though, was alienating people who also had their own contributions to make and who wanted to have some influence with me, not just be, you know, dictated to. And Marianne really helped me understand that my I was going to accomplish more by operating at scale with a large group of people who were also invested in the mission. Now, that didn't mean I was giving up influence. It didn't mean that we were just putting things to a vote. I still had a role to play. But I was going to have a lot more impact if I could be influential with people instead of just believing that I had the best ideas to contribute. So it was a really, you know, a profound kind of rethinking of how I could add value as a leader, which is certainly, you know, has had a big impact on how I coach people and is very relevant to our topic today.
Well, I mean, you have huge influence, both in your writing and in your one-on-one coaching. So, I also want to just say here at the outset, thank you, right? When I started my coaching journey 10 years ago, conversation we had that really kind of unleashed and got me going. So thank you for that and the subsequent conversations.
I appreciate that. Also appreciate that our shared interest in, more generally power, more specifically the work of Jeff Pfeffer. You know, I know that he's been a big influence on both of us. And in fact, the article that you referenced at the beginning of this hour, Power Struggles Among Nice People, I dedicated to Jeff because of his impact on me.
Yeah. So let's dive into power. And as I said, I want to kind of two areas here. The first is what you find in your practice that the nice people, highly conscientious people you work with, most holds them back, particularly around this dimension. But more importantly is, you know, how as we as coaches and you in particular in your practice help them work through it. Right? You're not telling them what to do. They're not kind of guessing. It's a process, a partnership as a coach. So those are the two areas I want to focus on. And, it's been the centerpiece of my coaching practice. Jeff has definitely influenced me. You talk about, right, with the senior leaders that you work with, you work on effectiveness, challenges and fulfillment, but have mentioned in multiple articles, and there was the one about 8,000 coaching sessions, that power dynamics, you picked kind of six areas that really stood out. And you said that power dynamics always emerges and is quite important. And I just want to quote here because I thought it was important. You wrote, whatever their goals, if the client is to succeed, they must recognize how power works and improve their ability to engage and win in power struggles. So to start us off in your practice, how does this topic emerge or present itself when you start working with a client?
Yeah, well, a starting point is the individual's beliefs about power. And the definitions that we use. I think it's really important when you talk about power struggles that we clarify what we mean. You know, it's most often that phrase is sort of conceptualized as like, you know, a bitter duel, you know, an antagonistic rivalry. And of course, sometimes that's the case, but you know, that's actually a relatively small number of power struggles. Most, what I really mean by power struggles is an alternative to the other formal decision-making mechanisms that we have, which are basically voting, consensus, and hierarchy. And, you know, when you think about it, there are many limitations on voting, consensus, and hierarchy. They do not apply in a lot of circumstances. So what we're left with in a very kind of general all-purpose way are power struggles. And so first we have to understand what we mean by power struggles. And if we have too narrow a definition, the reason why you said at the outset here, people often cringe when they think about power is because they think of power struggles in that very limited way. And so they think, well, I'm a good person. I'm an ethical person. I don't want to fight dirty. I don't want to undermine people. I don't want to engage in like nasty corporate politics. Okay, fine. But you're still engaging in power struggles and you still have to figure out how to win them. So if your conception of what a power struggle is too limited, you're almost certainly going to undermine yourself and be less effective at engaging in those power struggles. So, a starting point is often just understanding, how do people think about power? How do they conceptualize it?
And how do you get them to expand the way they think, right? I think that is a loaded word, power struggles and winning, right? You know, as soon as you hear that, you immediately go to these notions that you just suggested. How do you get them to kind of expand and think more, you know, widely about that, more creatively about that?
One is just like being real clear on what are the limitations of these other formal decision-making mechanisms that we have available to us. You know, we voting. I mean, how often do you actually vote on something in the business world? Very rarely. right? For any number of reasons. What does it mean to have a vote? Who gets a vote? You know, how is voting power, you know, also ultimately, if people with power and authority don't like the outcome of a vote, they're not going to abide by the vote. So there are very few circumstances in which you actually vote. Consensus, you know, in some circumstances, we really do need like everybody there to agree, or at least support, or at least agree not to oppose a given idea or a decision. But that's often very time consuming. And we just, you know, we can't afford the energy it's going to take to reach consensus. So there are many circumstances under which consensus doesn't work. Hierarchy, well, we rely on hierarchy quite a bit. But in the world I operate, where you know, almost all the employees are, you know, very talented knowledge workers who don't simply want to be issued commands, or where the people lower in the organizational chart are actually closer to the problem and have more expertise than the people in the management ranks, simply issuing a command from, you know, the top of your chart actually isn't going to necessarily lead to the best solution. And it may alienate the most talented people who are going to want to operate with more autonomy and latitude. So hierarchy often doesn't work. And again, we're left with power struggles. So just, you know, kind of understanding what we mean and normalizing it, like making it be okay. And I'm a little, you know, I'm a little deliberately provocative by talking about like, hey, we've got to engage successfully in power struggles to be successful. But I take a page out of Jeff Pfeffer's book, who I think is also deliberately provocative with the same, you know, with the same goal in mind.
Yeah. So when you are working with your senior leaders and this topic, you know, the traditional mechanisms are not there. Power struggles, they recognize that exist. What are the top two or three things, you know, if we just pick a couple of them here that seem to emerge that they can't quite get their heads around, or, you know, yeah, I can't do that, or that's just unfair. What tends to come up in your practice with executives you work with?
In thinking about this, I draw really heavily on the work of a guy named David McClelland. He's, you know, one of the most preeminent 20th century social psychologists, and his work on not just power, but on motivation is really critical here. He's best known for what is called the motivational needs theory, the idea that people generally have three needs: need for achievement, need for power, need for affiliation. Need for achievement is like you want to demonstrate your personal capability, you want to do it better than other people. Need for power is you want to have influence over others and outcomes and the world in general. And need for affiliation is you want to have sort of warm, you know, personal affective relationships with others. McClelland's work found that the most successful leaders had a relatively high need for power and a relatively low need for affiliation and strong impulse control. And what we found, what he found, and certainly what I see in my practice, is that people with a very high need for achievement, you know, want to do it better, want to demonstrate capabilities, don't necessarily make the most effective leaders because they have to do it their way. Mm. And it doesn't necessarily translate into scale. Now, when we talk about a relatively high need for power, sometimes that gets people thinking about very like authoritarian, heavy-handed, dictatorial leaders. That's not at all what McClelland's talking about. There's another pattern that he saw in his research, which he called conquistador syndrome. People have a very high need for power and a very low need for affiliation and low impulse control. So all of that translates into very self-aggrandizing, you know, displays of behavior. Look at me, I'm super, you know, I'm super authoritative and powerful. That's not what he's talking about. What he's talking about is your need for power is just high enough, you know, high enough relative to your need for affiliation that you're not held back by the desire to be liked and you're willing to engage in conflict. But you also have a high degree of impulse control. So you don't run roughshod over people. You don't act in self-aggrandizing ways that ultimately turn people off. So getting people to understand what is your need for affiliation? Because if it's too high, you're going to need to be liked and you're going to be unwilling to engage in conflict. You're not going to be an effective leader, or you're going to be less effective than you might be. What's your need for achievement? Because if you got to do it your way, if you got to demonstrate how personally capable you are, you're going to have less of, it's going to be harder for you to operate at scale through other people. And what's your degree of impulse control? Because if, you know, again, you still want to have power and influence and you want to be you want to have great impact, but that can't translate into self-aggrandizing displays. Otherwise, it's going to turn people off. So all of those are you know, there are lots of pathways and avenues for me to work with a client on what is getting in their way, what is preventing them from being more influential and powerful.
And not to go too far down that research, you know, because you started that with when he looked at successful leaders, right? Success has many definitions. What was kind of the operating definition there that we're optimizing on, because is getting to the top success, right? If you run the company into the ground, what was success there?
He's defining it in terms of the ability to sustain a career at the highest organizational levels, to avoid derailing as a result of, you know, a resistance to feedback, an inability to develop warm relationships, difficulty in adapting to change. So, you know, I mean, those are the patterns that we see in executives who top out at a certain level and then ultimately derail.
Yeah.
You've been listening to 97% Effective with your host, executive coach Michael Winderoth. If this interview is making you think, make sure to share it with a friend. Now, back to our interview.
So you mentioned those were kind of pathways to work with them. You know, this affiliation comes up, the need to be liked or to want harmony. You know, as a coach, you know, part of that is creating self-awareness and getting them to think about that. You know, if they do recognize some of that, what are some of the ways that you help them look at that, examine it, explore it?
Yeah, well, one starting point goes back to a point I made earlier. What are your beliefs and how do you conceptualize power and influence? You know, is it, you know, do you associate it with, you know, negative outcomes? Do you believe that only, you know, bad people, you know, operate in an influential way? Do you have difficulty kind of with the idea of being strategic and intentional about influencing people? You know, it's not uncommon for someone to say, oh, that feels very Machiavellian, you know, that feels very manipulative. And look, could you take any of this to a certain extreme? Of course, you know. But I think a simple definition of manipulation is: are you withholding material information and ultimately getting people to advocate against their own best interests? You know, I mean, it's a gray area, right? That's not necessarily there's a clear boundary, but it's easy for folks sometimes to think, I shouldn't be. If I am seeking to be intentional and deliberate and strategic about influencing people in a certain way, that's automatically sort of de facto manipulation. Well, that's one way of thinking about it. But I think if you put certain guardrails in place for yourself and say, well, I understand that there's a difference between seeking to be influential and impactful and being manipulative or Machiavellian, I can trust myself to sort of understand that there are some lines that I shouldn't cross. So one starting point is just understanding how do you think about power? Because if you automatically think about exerting power as, you know, a form of manipulation, then it's going to be very difficult to exert power effectively.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. I mean, as soon as you start to talk about power, again, like I said in the introduction, cringe comes the word. And even after I've worked with people, right? I give an example, right? A European woman who's now in Silicon Valley worked with her. She is now the CEO of a startup. And we did tremendous work as she thought about how to increase her influence. I asked her to come on the show and share some of that. She said, I would love to, but I can't bring myself to talk publicly about power. Yet people, it's interesting. As soon as you change that word to influence, suddenly kind of it seems okay. And do you feel or you know, kind of these differences, right? A lot of people conflate them, but would you draw any distinction between the two?
Not necessarily. And I think that's part of Jeff's genius, right? I think that's why Jeff calls the class Path to Power. I think he's being deliberately provocative, and he wants to kind of, you know, poke a finger in the eye of people who view power as sort of nasty. And if we soften it and call it influence, you know, that's fine. You know, I don't think there's a problem with that. But I think he's there's a method to the madness in his efforts to be sort of provocative and to get people to understand. And you know, Jeff's also very explicit about the fact that you can act in unethical ways. I do believe knowing Jeff personally, he cares quite a lot about ethics. He is not in the least suggesting, oh, hey, just go forth and use these tools in unethical ways. But something that Jeff makes really clear is, you know, the unethical people are going to use these tools anyway. So if you care about ethics, if you care about having a positive impact on the world, then, you know, why don't you Do us all a favor and learn how to use these tools more effectively. Don't just sort of opt out of power and influence and the power struggles that you're necessarily going to be involved in, because that's only something that unethical people do. I think if you abandon the field of power and influence to unethical people, well, we know what the result's going to be.
Mm. And I imagine, Ed, you know, again, those pathways, when you talk about achievement, I mean, you're in the epicenter, Silicon Valley founders have achievement. Boy, do they have achievement. And, you know, until, you know, it runs out, you kind of described what can happen. And so there is it kind of like Marianne did with you, kind of recognizing the limits of what you're doing. Are there other elements that kind of get them past that? Because if they don't, we know that most founders kind of flame out or are taken out because they can't scale. Yeah. Any reflections there? Because I know you work with tech CEOs, a lot of founder CEOs.
Well, I think
CEOs.
There's a huge balance there. It's a really significant challenge. Founders and other early stage leaders, you know, rightfully believe in certain circumstances. Hey, I know that I'm going to have higher standards, or I'm going to understand this problem more effectively, and I'm going to get in the weeds. I'm going to go into so-called founder mode, and that's fine, right? I'm not in the least suggesting that. Effective leadership consists solely of delegation. The question is a matter of judgment. You know, are you able to discern, hey, this is a problem or a challenge or an aspect of organizational life where I really need to exert ownership. And in some cases, I'm going to be quite directive. You know, there's nothing wrong with exerting directive authority, you know, especially when you're the founder, right? Founders often going to have a perspective on the problem space, on the users, on the technology, and is going to be able to conceptualize things very quickly. So at certain moments, the founder should absolutely be, you know, quite in the weeds and quite directive. There's nothing wrong with that. And if that's the only way you operate, you know, if you try to approach every single problem from that perspective, it's unlikely to attract people who are going to be high agency, high autonomy, and are going to want to experiment on their own. So part of the, I think, a critical factor here, not just for founders, but for any leaders, to understand at what point, you know, should I begin to essentially rely less on my personal capabilities, less on my ability to do, and more on my ability to lead, more on my ability to, you know, set a vision, create a culture, create an environment in which people are motivated to do their best work and their creative problem solving. You know, if that's simply, you know, it can't simply rest on the leader just turning the crank, you know, faster and faster. That doesn't scale.
Mm. Ed, also, you know, one thing to start asking them, you know, how they think about these things, affiliation, achievement. You also write a lot about self-awareness, getting feedback, giving feedback. And so I'm interested, and because again, we're working, I also work primarily one-on-one. So you are a very small percentage of the time. You are not in the room with them. You are not seeing or hearing necessarily from others unless you deliberately design that into your engagement. How do you get some of this? Because many people have blind spots. They will tell you stories. You might have to triangulate to get to the truth or how others perceive them. How are you getting them or yourself gathering kind of rich feedback to help them, right? Because if we can't recognize there's some truth or how others perceive us, hard to work on anything. How do you do that in your practice?
Well, it's very much based in the idea that, all of life is a laboratory for learning. And in all of organizational life, especially, it's not as if you need to engage in these sort of elaborate exercises to generate feedback. Now, I'm all in favor of activities like that. It's much of what you and I were engaged in when we were students at the business school. It's much of what I was involved in my years, you know, teaching and coaching and facilitating at the business school. I see lots of other programs in which, you know, my clients and others are able to participate in, exercises and workshops that are going to generate feedback, or they are going to, have a 360 conducted in their organization. There are lots of ways to do that. But, you know, it's not as if we sort of flip into learning mode only under these special circumstances. You know, ultimately, any conversation, any interaction, any meeting, any domain in organizational life has the potential to be a subject for learning about these kinds of topics. With a degree of self-awareness, I think a key point that you just mentioned, are you going into these interactions first, you know, with a set of goals, and maybe, you know, pertaining to our topic at hand, with a set of influence goals. You know, I'm seeking to have a specific kind of impact in this setting. You know, and so, in some cases, it's a little bit more obvious and explicit. Like, oh, there's a negotiation. Well, you probably have a set of, you know, goals for the outcome of that negotiation. How are you thinking about your ability to exert power and influence in this negotiation? How are you thinking about the kinds of behaviors that you might exhibit, demonstrate, or refrain from exhibiting in order to have the desired effect on the other person? All of that's grist for learning. And are you then at, you know, are you doing a retro on those kinds of activities, which, you know, may be in a coaching session with me, but may also be on your own, especially because you're going to have a lot more opportunity to do that work. It doesn't, you shouldn't be just saving it up for a special conversation in a coaching session. So there's a great metaphor from the management literature. Frederick Hertzberg, you know, you got to be able to kind of be on the dance floor, you know, kind of making the moves and simultaneously go up in the balcony and observe yourself on the dance floor. So something I work with clients quite a bit on is, are you able to do that, you know, do that dance and both in the moment, you know, maybe adjust your behavior to have the desired outcome, but certainly at the end of a given experience, are you able to step back and say, how did I do? How'd that go? How do I want to modify my behavior in order to have to be more effective and improve the outcomes going forward?
So a lot of, you know, structured reflection, going up on the balcony, whether that's in the coaching session or on their own. So, but do you use 360 mechanisms or, you know, structured interviews that you hold with stakeholders, or is that not part of how you work with clients?
It's not part of my practice. Okay. I don't do 360s. I used to for a number of years. I've reviewed tons of them. Mm. I don't have a problem with 360s, although I do think they have some inherent limitations. And I'm often skeptical of simply viewing the 360 as like the answer. Mm. You know, a dilemma with 360s is that the structure of the instrument kind of presupposes that, well, the leader's not getting the truth. The leader can't have a candid conversation. Mm. And so the truth is going to come from these anonymous sources of data. You know, there is a version of that that's true in lots of organizations in which people feel precluded from being candid and direct. And so, you know, an anonymous 360 can generate information that might not otherwise be available. However, the idea that what comes out of an anonymous, you know, instrument is the truth is also, I think, very problematic. It's not necessarily the truth. It is biased in certain ways. One biasing mechanism that we see in 360s is that it kind of presupposes that the recipient of the feedback, maybe the CEO, is the sort of the sole player on the field. And all the raters, everyone providing feedback, are like, you know, spectators in the stands. Well, that's not true. That's not how it operates. Everyone who's giving feedback is also on the field with the CEO, helping to create the conditions of play. And the dilemma is that people rarely, when they're, you know, raters in a 360, take some responsibility for their own contributions to that field of play. So, you know, 360 reports are invariably biased to the negative, in which the raters do not take responsibility for their own contributions, leaving the recipient of the feedback. And I've had this conversation countless times with CEOs wondering, well, what the hell do I do with this?
Yeah.
Because first, this imagines that I'm responsible for everything and I can wave a wand and change things. And that's not the case. So I do think there's value in a 360, but the delivery of the 360 report is just a milestone in the process. What's key is that next, the CEO or the recipient of the report, you know, take that and then have a discussion with the raters and say, well, here's what I heard. Here's some things that I can change. Here's some things that I could change with your help. Here's some things that aren't going to change. But that's a much longer process.
Yeah. So it does sound like in your practice that, and this is a theme that I see also in your writing, of building trust, being able to have those conversations. There's certainly a power dynamic, right? If the CEO is, you know, what they do with it or the conversations they have. But if you can get that rich feedback or they can do that, you're going to get more self-awareness, more ability to act or do something with that.
Sure. And again, there's value in conducting a 360, but let's not imagine that it's the magical solution and that when the delivery of the report, you know, is complete, that the process is over. At that point, really, I'd say the process is just beginning.
Yeah, it's just starting. Ed, this has been a great discussion on what gets in the way of highly conscientious people when they run into power struggles at work. We talked about better understanding your motivational needs and gaining self-awareness. But we didn't get to touch on touchy-feely, which is such a rich topic that I'm bringing you back next week to dive into that. So we're going to end with Ed Batista and the episode today here and come back next week to discuss his past work teaching touchy-feely. Actually, it is the famed course called Interpersonal Dynamics at Stanford Business School. And we're going to talk about the influence it has had on Ed and his coaching and why he argues that touchy-feely interpersonal dynamics is a fantastic laboratory for understanding influence and power. Can't wait. So join me next week as we dig into touchy-feely and Ed Batista here on 97% Effective. And Ed, how do people reach you? I know it's edbatista.com. You prefer other mechanisms that they follow you?
Oh, no. Edbatista.com is where all my content is.
Awesome. Thank you, Ed.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks for listening to 97% Effective, where we skip happy talk and help you break through and ascend one hard truth at a time. Help others discover this show. Leave a review and rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you like what you heard, you can get free resources, including the first chapters of Michael's book, Get Promoted, on his website, www.changwinderoth.com. That's www.changwenderoth.com.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.